The reply was in a frail old man's quaver that he hardly recognized. "Come again. We have more to discuss. Come back in 2 days." The stiffness went out of Zuga's stance. He started to turn back, but the old man waved him away with a brusque gesture, and Zuga stamped down the front steps, vaulted into the saddle, and whipped his mount into a gallop along the narrow rutted track. Harkness sat at the table until long after the hoofbeats had faded. Strange that the pain had receded to the very back of his consciousness during the hours that he had sat with the youngster. He had felt young and strong, as though he had suckled upon the vigour and the youth of the other. Then it had come back with a savage rush at Zuga Ballantyne's invitation, almost as if to remind him that his life was no longer his, that it was already forfeit to the hyena that lived deep in his belly, each day growing stronger, bigger, as it fed upon his vitals. When he closed his eyes, he could imagine it, the way that he had seen it so often in the light of 1,000 campfires, up there in the wonderful land that he would never visit again. The thing within him had the same furtive, slinking presence, and he could taste the fetid breath of it in his throat. Now he gasped at the full strength of the pain, as the beast buried its fangs deeper into his gut. He knocked over the chair in his haste to reach the precious bottle in the back of the cabinet, and he gulped a mouthful of the clear, pungent liquid, without measuring it into the spoon. It was too much, he knew that. But each day he needed more to keep the hyena at bay, and each day the relief took longer to come. He clung to the corner of the cabinet and waited for it. "Please," he whispered, "please let it end soon." There were half a dozen messages and invitations awaiting Zuga on his return to the Cartwright estate that morning, but the one which gave him most excitement was an official Admiralty paper, a polite request to call upon the Honourable Ernest Kemp, Rear Admiral of the Blue, officer commanding the Cape Squadron. Zuga shaved and changed his clothing, selecting his best jacket for the occasion, although it was a long, dusty ride to Admiralty House. Despite missing a night's sleep, he felt vital and alert. The Admiral's secretary kept him waiting only a few minutes before showing him through, and Admiral Kemp came round from behind his desk to greet Zuga amiably, for the young man came highly recommended, and Fuller Ballantyne's name still commanded respect in Africa. "I have some news which I hope will please you, Major Ballantyne. But first, a glass of Madeira?" Zuga had to curb his impatience while the Admiral poured the syrupy wine. The Admiral's study was decorated richly, with velvet furnishings and a fashionable profusion of ornaments, small statues, bric-a-brac, stuffed birds in glass showcases, family portraits in ornate frames and pretty ceramics, potted plants, and the kind of paintings which Zuga admired. The Admiral was tall but stooped, as though to accommodate his long frame to the limited headroom between the decks of one of Her Majesty's ships. He seemed old for the responsible appointment he held, guarding the Empire's lifeline to India and the East. But the ageing may have been caused by ill health rather than years. There were dark-toned pouches of skin below his eyes, and other marks of sickness carved around his mouth, and evident in the distended blue veins on the back of his hands as he handed a glass of Madeira to Zuga.
Your good health, Major Ballantyne."
And then after he'd tasted his own wine, "I think I have a berth for you. A ship of my squadron anchored in Table Bay yesterday, and as soon as she has replenished her coal bunkers and revictualled, I shall detach her for independent duty in the Mozambique Channel." Zuga knew from his meetings with the directors of the Society for the Extinction of the Slave Trade that one part of the Admiral's standing orders read, "You are requested and required to dispose the ships of your squadron in such a manner as most expediently to prevent vessels of whatever Christian nation from engaging in the slave trade on the coast of the African continent south of the equator." Clearly, Kemp intended a sweep of the eastern seaboard with elements of his squadron, and Zuga felt awakening delight as the Admiral went on genially. It will not need much of a diversion for my ship to call at Quelimane, and to land you and your party.
I cannot thank you sufficiently, Admiral.
His pleasure was transparent, and Admiral Kemp smiled in sympathy. He had put himself out more than his usual wont, for the youngster was attractive and likable, deserving of encouragement. But now there were other matters awaiting his attention, and as he pulled out his gold hunter and consulted it pointedly, he went on. You should be ready to sail in 5 days' time. He returned the watch to the fob of his uniform coat. I hope we will see you on Friday. My secretary did send you an invitation, did he not? Your sister will be with you, I hope.
Indeed, sir.
Zuger stood in obedience to his dismissal. And my sister and I are honoured. In fact, Robin had said, I do not waste my evenings, Zuger, and I have no intention of enduring the company of a fleet of tipsy sailors, nor of suffering the wagging tongues of their wives. The Cape wives were agog with the presence in their midst of the notorious Robin Ballantyne, who had impersonated a man and invaded successfully an exclusive masculine preserve. Half of them were deliciously scandalized, and the rest were awed and admiring. However, Zuger was certain that she would pay his price for their passage to Quelimane.
Very well, then,
Admiral Kemp nodded. Thank you for calling on me. And then, as Zuger started for the door,
Oh, by the way, Ballantyne, the ship is the Black Joke, Captain Codrington commanding. My secretary will give you a letter for him, and I suggest you call upon him to introduce yourself and to learn the date of sailing.
The name came as a shock, and Zuger checked his stride as he thought quickly of the complication which the choice of ship might bring. Zuger was sensitive to any threat to the expedition, and Codrington had struck him as being a hot-headed, almost fanatical character. He could not afford any slur to his leadership, and Codrington had seen him sailing in company with a suspected slaver. He could not be sure what Codrington would do. It was a delicate decision. Accept the berth and risk Codrington's denunciation, or refuse the offer of passage and perhaps wait for months in Cape Town before another vessel offered them another. If they were delayed that long, it would mean missing the cooler and drier period between the monsoons. They would have to cross the pestilential and fever-ridden coastal lowlands in the most dangerous season. Zuger made his decision. Thank you, Admiral Kemp. I will call on Captain Codrington as soon as possible. Thomas Harkness had asked Zuger to return on the second day, and the map was more important even than swift passage to Quelimane. Zuger sent Chanit, the cartwright's groom, down to the beach with a sealed letter addressed to Captain Codrington, and with instructions to take one of the water boats out to Black Joke and deliver it personally to Codrington. It was a warning, couched in the most polite terms, that Zuger and Robin would call on the captain the following morning. Zuger had become aware that his sister had an effect on men quite out of proportion to her physical appearance. Even Admiral Kemp had asked for her personally, and he had no compunction in using her to take the edge off Codrington's temper. He would have to warn her to exert her charm, but now there was more important business. He had mounted on Cartwright's big bay gelding and ridden halfway down the gravelled drive between the oaks when a thought struck him, and he swung the horse's head and cantered back to the guest bungalow again. The naval Colt revolver was on the top layer of his chest, already fully loaded and with caps on the nipples. He carried it under the tail of his coat while he went back out to the tethered gelding and then slipped the revolver surreptitiously into the saddlebag as he swung up into the saddle. He knew he had to have the Harkness map at any price, but he deliberately refused to think what that price might be. He pushed his mount hard up the steep road to the neck between the peaks and gave him only a few minutes to blow before starting down the far slope. The air of dilapidation which hung over the thatched building in the Milkwood Grove seemed to have deepened. It seemed totally deserted, silent and desolate. He dismounted and threw his reins over a milkwood branch and stooped to ease the girth. Then he quietly unfastened the buckle of the saddlebag and slipped the colt into his waistband
and pulled his coat over it. As he started towards the stoop, the big ridgeback boarhound rose from where it had lain in the shadows and came to meet him. In contrast to its previous ferocity, the animal was subdued, its tail and ears drooping, and it whined softly when it recognized Zuga. He went up onto the stoop and hammered on the front door with his fist and heard the blows reverberate through the room beyond. Beside him, the boarhound cocked its head and watched him expectantly, but silence settled again over the old building. Twice more Zuga beat upon the door before he tried the handle. It was locked. He rattled the brass lock and put his shoulder to the door, but it was heavy teak in a solid frame. Zuga jumped down off the stoop and circled the house, squinting his eyes at the fierce reflected sunlight from the whitewashed walls. The windows were shuttered. Beyond the farmyard stood the old slave quarters, now used by Harkness' servant, and Zuga called loudly for him. But his room was deserted, and the ashes cold in the cooking place. Zuga went back to the main house and stood by the locked kitchen door. He knew that he should go back to his horse and ride away. But he needed the map, even if just for long enough to make a copy. Harkness was not here, and in 3 days, perhaps less, he would be sailing out of Table Bay. There was a pile of broken, rusted garden tools in the corner of the stoop. Zuga selected a hand scythe and carefully probed the metal point of the blade into the crack between jamb and door. The lock was old and worn. The tongue slipped back easily under the blade, and he jerked the door open with his free hand. It was still not too late. He paused in the doorway for many seconds, and then he took a deep breath and stepped quietly into the gloom of the interior. There was a long passage leading past closed doors towards the front room. Zuga went down it, opening doors quietly as he passed. In one room was a huge four-poster bedstead with the curtains open and the bedclothes in disorder. Quickly, Zuga passed on to the main room. It was in semi-darkness, and he stopped to let his eyes adjust, and immediately was aware of a low sound. The hive murmur of insects seemed to fill the high room. It was a disturbing, almost menacing sound, and Zuga felt his skin prickle on his forearms. "Mr. Harkness!" he called hoarsely, and the hum rose to a loud buzzing. Something alighted on his cheek and crawled across his skin. He struck it away with a shudder of revulsion and stumbled across to the nearest window. His fingers were clumsy on the fastening of the shutters. A shaft of white sunlight burned into the room as the shutter swung open. Thomas Harkness sat in one of the curved wing-back chairs across the cluttered table and stared at Zuga impassively. The flies crawled over him, big metallic blue and green flies that glittered in the sunlight. They swarmed with evident glee upon the deep, dark wound in the centre of his chest. The snowy beard was black with clotted blood, and blood had formed a congealed pool beneath his chair. Zuga was rooted by the shock for many seconds, and then reluctantly he took a step forward. The old man had propped one of his big bored elephant guns against the table leg, reversing the weapon so the muzzle pressed into his own chest, and his hands were still locked round the barrel. "What did you do that for?" Zuga demanded stupidly, speaking aloud. And Harkness stared back at him. Harkness had removed the boot from his right foot and depressed the trigger with his bare toe. The massive impact of the heavy lead ball had driven the chair and the man in it back against the wall, but he had retained his death grip on the barrel. "That was a stupid thing to do." Zuga took a cheroot from his case and lit it with a Swan Vesta. The smell of death was in the room, coating the back of his throat and the roof of his mouth. Zuga drew deeply on the tobacco smoke. There was no reason at all to feel grief. He had known the old man for a single day and night. He had come here for one reason only, to get the map the best way he was able. It was ridiculous now to have the deep ache of sorrow turning his legs leaden and stinging the backs of his eyes. Was he mourning the passing of an era, perhaps, rather than the man himself? Harkness and the legends of Africa were interwoven. The man had been history itself. Slowly Zuga approached the figure in the chair, and then reaching out drew his palm slowly down over the old face, ruined by elements and by pain, closing the lids down over the staring black eyes. The old man looked more peaceful that way. Zuga hooked one leg over the corner of the cluttered table and smoked the cheroot slowly, in almost companionable silence with Thomas Harkness. Then he dropped the stub in the big copper spittoon beside the chair and went through to the bedroom. He took one of the blankets of the bed and brought it back. He brushed the flies away into an angry, buzzing circle and threw the blanket over the seated figure. As he drew it up over the head, he murmured softly, "Get in close, old man, and go for the heart." The advice that Harkness had given him as a farewell.